Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is holding steady, telling Americans to do the basic things needed to curb the spread of COVID-19.
It's exhausting, but this is too important a problem and has too much important implications to really be worrying about how tired I am, which I really am.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and for this Wednesday, November 25th on The Takeaway, a weary Dr. Fauci joins us to reflect on the year and what's ahead. And believe it or not, we've been here before. Back in 1918, our country was also in the midst of a pandemic, but by Thanksgiving, it was almost over.
In 1918, things were actually getting a lot better for most of the country by the time of Thanksgiving. It was the end of the war. The war had ended on November 11th, so it really was a time of celebration.
Plus, we'll speak with some of our familiar film critics about what you should be watching at home this weekend. There have been record numbers of coronavirus cases leading up to this holiday, and with an increase in travel and family gatherings, we'll likely see an even more dire situation in the weeks to come than we faced last spring. Here to update us on where we stand in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic is Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's been working as the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. But it was only this year that he acquired a kind of rock star status as the voice of reason and science on COVID-19. Dr. Fauci is, of course, a member of the White House Task Force on the Coronavirus. Dr. Fauci, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
So before we talk about the latest on the coronavirus, Dr. Fauci, how are you doing?
Well, you know, I'm hanging in there. We're really being challenged with an extraordinary situation here in our country and actually throughout the world. You know, we're experiencing, you know, historically the worst pandemic respiratory outbreak literally in 102 years. And there's been an awful lot of suffering and considerable amount of death already. And we are in the middle of what looks like, you know, a persistent surge as we enter into the deep fall and early winter. There are a lot of things that we can do to help prevent the kind of surge that we hope we don't get. We're already in the middle of a considerable surging of cases and hospitalizations. And we're trying to get the message out to people of the simple things that they can do without shutting down the country, without locking down, simple things like mask wearing and keeping a physical distance and avoiding crowds in congregate spaces, that you can actually go a long way to blunting the trajectory of the curve. You know, I try my best to get that message across. It's exhausting, but this is too important a problem and has too much important implications to really be worrying about how tired I am, which I really am, to be honest with you.
You've been at the center of so many of our national public health crises for so many decades. I can only imagine how tired you must be, particularly Dr. Fauci. You know, you laid out some of the basics that we've all been hearing about for the past couple of months: wearing a mask, keeping a 6-foot physical distance from others, not going indoors into non-ventilated spaces, et cetera. And yet we are experiencing a surge, and it's a very serious surge. When you watch this happening, I mean, why do you think some Americans just haven't gotten the message? The CDC said, please don't travel for Thanksgiving, which is this week. And yet, while there aren't the same numbers of Americans traveling as they normally would be, there are still folks doing it. So when you see this happening, how does it make you feel, and why is this happening?
Well, you know, it is really quite frustrating because the data are staring us right in the face. When we look at the hospitalizations, the number of cases, we've now 21 days in a row over 100,000 cases, and in some respects approaching and sometimes reaching 200,000, you know, anywhere between, you know, 1,000 and 1,500 or more deaths and hospitalizations, some of which are now hospitals are being challenged with regard to the number of staff that they would need. And yet, you know, people, I believe, are really beset with what we refer to as COVID fatigue. They're really tired of, you know, of any kind of restriction, particularly when you're entering into such a traditionally enjoyable part of the year, the holiday season. Another thing that I think contributes to this lack of hearing or paying attention to the message is the extraordinary political divisiveness that we've experienced now in the middle of a pandemic, that there are people in different parts of the country and even people differing within a given region of really associating a certain type of behavior with a certain political stance or political ideology, which just complicates things. We really need to get the message across to people that this is a public health issue. The enemy is the virus. The enemy is not the people that are telling you the kinds of things you can do to avoid infection. And the enemy is not the people who don't seem to be hearing that or don't want to adhere to it. We're all in this together. And the only way we're going to get out of it in a way that minimizes the negative impact is if we work together, you know, as a country, because we're really being challenged with something that's unprecedented. The messaging that we're trying to get across, you know, understandable, people sometimes hear mixed messages and wind up saying they don't believe anything. Well, that's really unfortunate, and that may be in part due to some of the mixed messaging. But right now, the message is clear. We can do something about this. And I think it's important to point out that help is really on the way. We are going to have vaccine available in different priority orders starting in the middle to the end of December. And as we get into the first quarter of 2021, more and more people at a various prioritization will be getting vaccines. And that's going to be a huge difference. So rather than saying, well, we're going to have a vaccine, let's not worry about anything, I think it should prompt us to double down even more and say, yes, this is difficult to do these kinds of things. It definitely interferes and upends our life. But help is on the way. And if we can hang on a bit longer and adhere to these public health measures, then we have a long future ahead of being without this pandemic, because we can actually not only blunt it, we can actually crush it with a combination of public health measures and wide utilization of the vaccine. And that's not too far off. So the message that we keep almost pleading with the American public is, please hang in there with us, because help is on the way and we will end this. This is not something that's going to go on indefinitely. We have the capability of ending it.
You said help is on the way, and with that will come some hope in the form of a vaccine. There have been a couple of companies, Pfizer and others, who have said that they are very close to a vaccine. Let's talk about what that really looks like. How effective are some of these vaccines, Dr. Fauci? Because someone will hear, oh, it's 94.5% effective, and they'll think that's a miracle. Are they really? I mean, what does the effectiveness look like of these vaccines right now?
You know, it really is pretty solid. We have two vaccines now, that one 2.5 weeks ago and one just about a week and a half ago, have been shown in a rather large clinical trial to be safe, but also to be highly efficacious, to the tune of both of them about 95%. That's real data. That is an unprecedented effort was put into developing these vaccines and getting them mobilized as quickly as possible. In fact, in record time, without compromising safety and without compromising scientific integrity. It's a reflection of the extraordinary and spectacular advances in technologies that have allowed various types of vaccines to be mobilized quickly upon identification of the virus in question. And in this case, that would be this novel SARS coronavirus 2, where we just knew what it was in the first week of January. And in less than a year, we have vaccine that is ready to go into people by the middle and end of December, the federal government, under Operation Warp Speed, has invested an extraordinary amount of money, billions of dollars, to get the process going safely and quickly, and to pre-purchase doses of the vaccine so that when the efficacy and safety is proven, you can jump right in and start administering the vaccine, which is the reason why we can start doing that to certain high priority groups as we get into the middle and end of December. And then as we go into the first quarter of 2021, more and more people would get vaccinated until, as we get to the end of the first quarter and into the second quarter, hopefully, if people accept the vaccine and take the vaccine, we can provide, as we get into the first half and going into the second half of the year, a rather substantial blanket of protection over the country. So the question people ask is, do you believe this 95% efficacy and safety? And the answer is that determination was made by an independent body who is beholden not to the government, not to the pharmaceutical company, but is independent of highly skilled and experienced clinicians, vaccinologists, statisticians, infectious disease individuals, people who have a lot of experience, have looked at the data on both of those candidates, both the Pfizer and the Moderna candidate, and said, yes, this looks really good. This is a substantial advance. It's an efficacious and safe vaccine. So what they do then is that information is then given to the company, which then presents it to the FDA as a request for either an emergency use authorization or for full approval as a biological license application. Now, within the FDA, you have career scientists who do this for a living. These are not political people. These are people who are highly experienced in that. They will confer with their advisory committee, which again is an independent body. It's called the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, or VRBPAC. They get involved in the approval of vaccines all the time. They will look at the data and they will advise the FDA as to whether or not it would be appropriate to issue an emergency use authorization. And then finally, the data becomes public. It gets published in a journal, and everyone in the scientific community and anybody else who wants can get a look at it. So the people who have a concern that there may be, you know, cutting corners or undue political influence or companies trying to sidestep certain things, that just can't happen, both because of the independent nature of the evaluation, as well as for the transparency of the process. So that's the reason why we want to get as many people as you possibly can to take the vaccine, not only for their own personal protection, but also as a contribution to ending this pandemic so that we can put it behind us and not be gripped by the fear and the economic disruption and the suffering and the death that it has caused, not only us here in the United States, but throughout the world.
Some Americans, at least in most polls we've seen last week, 58% of adults said they would get vaccinated. But that leaves an additional almost half of the country saying they might not take this vaccine. Dr. Fauci, you know, similar to what we were just talking about, if not everybody is involved, how do we move forward? I mean, what would the consequences be of a country where 58% of adults take the vaccine and the remaining percentages don't?
Well, it would be really unfortunate at best, and really, really tragic at worst, if we have, which we do, a highly efficacious vaccine, but we don't put it to its maximum use because people do not want to get vaccinated. So we really need to reach out to the community of people who have skepticism about the vaccine and be very open and transparent about what I just told you of the process involved in this and how in the long run it's totally important and necessary for as many people to be vaccinated as possible, because if you only have half of the country, you don't get that veil of protection for everyone. If you really want to crush an outbreak, you have to have a very, very high percentage of people get vaccinated. We did that with smallpox. We did that with polio. We did that with measles. We absolutely can do that with COVID-19 and the virus that's caused by it. But it's going to require people to step up and say, I want to protect myself, but I also want to be part of the process to protect the rest of the country by creating that umbrella or that veil, as it were, that blanket of herd immunity by getting everyone protected. Because once you do that, the virus really has no place to go. Because if the overwhelming majority of the people are protected, the virus is just going to be eliminated, essentially. We can do that. It is within our power to do that.
So, Dr. Fauci, last week, Sweden banned gatherings of more than 8 people and implemented other restrictions. And this is significant because some people believe the government in Sweden had been implementing lax policies in an attempt to reach something that's called herd immunity. What's your take on herd immunity as it relates to this pandemic and the situation in Sweden?
Yeah, I think we need to put that to rest. Herd immunity, you want to get to by a vaccine. If you waited to get enough people to be infected in order to get herd immunity, which would require, you know, estimates anywhere from 60, 70, 80% of the population would have need to have been infected, there would have been an extraordinarily unacceptable level of deaths in this country if we did that. So herd immunity is something that we need to get by vaccines. The Swedes tried to do that. Their numbers under certain circumstances looked good. But when you compare the Swedes to other comparable Scandinavian countries, their death rates were significantly higher than virtually all of the other Scandinavian countries.
Dr. Fauci, what do we know so far about the potential for vaccine side effects? There are some reports that say it might require 2 injections. Not everybody's a fan of injections, but, you know, that's one inconvenience of it. Are there side effects, potentially, for example, autoimmune issues that some folks could come up against if they take the vaccine?
Well, first of all, I think it's important what you're saying about side effects, because you have to think in terms of immediate, intermediate, and long-range side effects. We have extensive experience with vaccines, and overall, they are very, very safe. There is not anything you could do that has absolutely no potential side effects, but the risk is extremely low. What we've learned so far is that the vaccines that have been used have some local effects that last maybe 24 hours, namely pain in the arm, some fever, a little aches that you have. Those have not been prohibitive in the sense of being a real significant problem. There have been no indications of severe adverse events that occur. And one of the reasons why the FDA has made it clear that they will not go for an emergency use authorization until there were at least 2 months, 60 days beyond the time when half of the people have gotten their last dose. And the reason for that is when you look at the overall history of vaccines, the overwhelming percentage, I believe it's more than 90% of the adverse events that occur generally occur somewhere between around 30 to 45 days. And that's the reason why they add that extra little safety net and say, we're not going to do anything until we're at least 60 days or 2 months out from that last dose. So the chances of there being long-range effects are really minimal. And in that regard, we will be looking well out into 1 and 2 years to see if there are really very long-term effects, which it is unlikely that that would happen. And getting to the number of doses, almost all, except for one, I believe, of the vaccines will require a prime and a boost. Some require just a single vaccination, but others would require a prime followed by a boost anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks later.
Dr. Fauci, you know these numbers very well. So far, the United States has had around 12 million cases of coronavirus. More than 250,000 Americans have died from the virus. At the same time, as we experience this current surge, we're seeing hospitals across the country, ICU units to capacity, and a real strain on our medical professionals, nurses, doctors, EMT workers, who have been essentially burned out for months already as they battle the virus. One thing I think that's curious is that we would normally, if we were watching something like this unfold in another country, I think the United States would try to send medical personnel out. Why haven't we asked for international medical personnel help on our end this time around?
We have enough capacity to send personnel. That could be with the help from military physicians and nurses and others. We do not need to ask for personnel help from the outside. So it isn't that we need it and we haven't asked for it for one reason or other. We have what it takes right now with our own capability. It is true that there are some facilities in different parts of the country that are being strained. They will likely get help pretty quickly from some of the reserves that we have. So I don't believe we're going to need help from the outside.
And how do we explain the high number of deaths in this pandemic, Dr. Fauci? As of Tuesday, data from the World Health Organization is showing that the United States reported 867 COVID deaths in the past 24 hours, while India reported 480. What is driving the high rates of, I guess, morbidity here in the United States?
You know, it's a very complicated situation that can't be explained by a single unidimensional answer. But I think you have to be careful. We accurately report our deaths and medical statistics. I think you have to be careful that some countries could, and I believe it's likely the case, I'm not pointing a finger at any given country, but some of the developing countries, you may get a little bit of a different perspective from them about deaths and hospitalizations because of the lack of accurate reporting in some of those countries. And again, I'm not pointing out any particular country, but be careful when you compare one to one from another country, particularly if it's a developing country with a poor healthcare system, that there may be deaths that occur that don't get counted. But that's not the issue. Let's just concentrate on what we have. The idea of so many deaths is really a complicated issue, and it could relate to many of the comorbidities that we have in our country. You know, a bit of an aging population and some, a lot of obesity, which is one of the really high risk issues that is a comorbidity that accounts for some of the deaths. The lack of uniformity of access to health care in a timely manner. All of these things that are some of the weaknesses in our population and in our society that seem to be contributing to this. And it's a very, very large country with a lot of people. And we have a situation where we're being stressed with this. And again, as I said, we have a lot of complicating issues, including the high percentage, you know, by some estimates, anywhere from 30% to 40% of people who have a condition that would essentially make them be more likely to have a serious consequence of getting ill. And by a serious consequence, I mean hospitalization, intensive care, and even death.
Dr. Fauci, what's bringing you joy in this moment?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's joy. What's bringing me hope, I would say that hopefully will lead to joy, is the fact that the things that we have, namely the vaccines that are now going to be coming rapidly online, more than one, that we will be able to put an end to this terrible ordeal that we've been going through, and that hopefully the kind of things, the little things in life that we had to put aside because of this outbreak will return, and with that will be that feeling of joy that is often characteristic of our country. My own self if you want to call it joy, is I'm thankful, actually, that my family is safe and that we have been spared illness. But I also feel a great deal of empathy for those who have suffered by either the loss of a loved one or a severe illness in themselves or in their loved ones.
Dr. Fauci, thank you so much and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and a member of the White House Task Force on the Coronavirus.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's been a lot of hardship and sorrow in 2020. So that old Thanksgiving question, what are you thankful for, has taken on new importance. And we asked you.
Hi, this is Andrew calling from Irvine, California. I'm a graduate student living in graduate student family housing, and I am grateful for the fact that despite the horrors of the pandemic, I've gotten so much closer to my immediate family and gotten to know my children in ways I never thought I would. I have three daughters, and they're all school-aged, and we share a very small apartment, but we've never loved each other more.
Bob and Shirley Rosenberg, Sacramento, California. We are found it challenging this year, but yes, a lot to be gratitude for good health after medical issues and beauty that we all still have to look forward to.
This is Pastor Christine. I lost my job this year. I've been isolated because I'm vulnerable to COVID. Even so, I'm very thankful for my life and for the comfort that I enjoy every day, even though I struggle. I hope that everyone can find something to take comfort in.
Paul in Minneapolis. I'm grateful most for my wife and my family. The fact that we have a roof over our heads and ample food and actually have a little extra that we can try to help those who need it more than we do.
I find that this year has made me aware of how much I actually have to be grateful for. Health, home, food, comfort, security, and most of all, I have had the time this year to cultivate my spiritual practices every day and actually come to a much deeper and greater appreciation for life and nature and well-being. So I am deeply grateful to be alive and well. This is Kate Mayo in Beaverton, Oregon. Thank you.
Of course, it's been very challenging. This will be the first time in 16 years we won't be hosting family for Thanksgiving at our house. Family that arrives from California, Texas, Bethesda, and Armonk, New York. But we are grateful for Zoom to be able to see our family. We're grateful for masked visits outside on patios. And I'm grateful for Zoom that allows me to seek spiritual satisfaction and motivation from various houses of worship across the country, not just limited to my own. Steve, Great Neck, New York.
I'm grateful for very simple things like I'm still alive and able to walk at age 76. I'm grateful for the two children I had. I'm grateful for how beautiful the sky looks on clear days. I'm grateful for having good neighbors and good friends.
As a result of the pandemic, I have more gratitude than I ever had before. I am so exceedingly grateful that my husband and I so far have maintained our health throughout the pandemic, as have all of our children and grandchildren, and I am so grateful that we get to see our grandchildren and children, or at least we did during the warm weather. And I just pinch myself every day that we wake up and we're still here and able to experience another day in this world of ours. And we know that this all will be behind us at some point. And the more we see how others are struggling health-wise, financial-wise, emotionally, we just feel such cornball attitude of gratitude much more than ever before. My name is Judy, and I live in New Rochelle.
Thank you to all of you who shared your thoughts. We had so many amazing calls, and although we weren't able to play all of them, we listened, as always, to every single one. Americans across the nation are putting their traditional Thanksgiving plans on hold this year as the number of COVID-19 cases in the country continues to rise. But this isn't the first time Americans have celebrated Thanksgiving during a pandemic. The 1918 flu pandemic claimed 50 million lives worldwide, including 675,000 Americans. So the Takeaway spoke to Alex Navarro, the assistant director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, to give us a look at how people celebrated Thanksgiving in 1918 and how it compares to today. And Alex started by reminding me about the state of the flu pandemic during Thanksgiving in 1918.
So in 1918, Thanksgiving came at the tail end of the fall wave, that deadly second wave. And so Thanksgiving was a little bit different than today. Today, we're still in the midst of our pandemic, of course, and we're in the third surge of it. Things are getting worse. In 1918, things were actually getting a lot better for most of the country by the time of Thanksgiving. And so it really was a time of celebration. It was the end of the war. The war had ended on November 11th. And so at least for those family members who hadn't lost someone, and of course, hundreds of thousands of people died during the fall wave of the pandemic in the United States. But for the rest of the country, it was a time of celebration.
Remind us, as we are being reminded today, to wear masks and social distance. What were the public health regulations back in 1918? Were they similar?
They were very similar. In some ways, they were not quite as sweeping. So there were a number of mask recommendations. And in some cities and communities, particularly out west, there were some mandatory mask mandates. There were also large numbers of school closures. Pretty much every community across the United States, with a few notable exceptions, New York City, for example, and Chicago, closed their schools, oftentimes several times closing their schools when they had another surge of cases.
Sounds like what we're going through here.
Exactly. They also closed places of public amusement. So these were the types of business closures that they utilized in 1918. They did not issue sweeping closures of all non-essential businesses, but they did close places like movie theaters, performance theaters, cafes, bowling alleys and dance halls, etc. But those are the types of closures that were used.
We're also hearing this year guidance from the CDC that's telling Americans not to travel for Thanksgiving to avoid passing COVID-19 on to more vulnerable family members. Were there similar restrictions on how people were allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving in 1918 in order to prevent the spread of the flu then?
You know, there weren't. And this is one of the interesting points of contrast. We often compare the 1918 pandemic with COVID-19. But this is a point of contrast. By and large, no, there were not warnings to not gather. In fact, people were told to go out and celebrate. Again, it was at the end of the war. And so if you had a service member in your family who was overseas in Europe, you were now happy, of course, that they would be coming home and being demobilized in the coming months. If you had a service member who was stationed in the United States, that person may have been able to get some leave and travel to come see you. And if not, if they couldn't travel or if it was too far, local families often took in soldiers and sailors from the local camps and naval stations to celebrate Thanksgiving. The pandemic was, again, largely over. At least the worst of it was over by the time of Thanksgiving. There was another wave in the winter of 1919, the third wave. It was deadly. It was not nearly as bad as the fall wave. And so for most of the country, again, for those who had not lost someone to the pandemic, people were really celebrating both the end of the pandemic, the end of the war, and a growing sense of a return to normalcy.
What did the media's coverage of that moment look like, of Thanksgiving during the 1918 pandemic?
Yeah, you know, if you look at the media coverage at the time, lots of notices of families who were willing to take in soldiers, for example, or clergy members who were hosting a large Thanksgiving gathering for those who had no family or for perhaps for the indigent. So really quite different than what we're experiencing today. And again, that was partly because of the timing of the epidemics. These are two, although we compare them, they're two very different diseases. And so they had two different types of pandemics. The curves looked different, but also because of public health messaging. Once they realized or thought that they were over that first big spike of cases in 1918, in the fall of 1918, most public health officials looked back and questioned a little bit whether or not those social distancing orders that they had implemented actually worked. The thought was that if they had worked, there wouldn't really be a pandemic. And of course, that wasn't true. We did have a pandemic. What they had done was they flattened the curve, but they didn't quite realize that at the time. And so there was a little bit of hand-wringing after that, thinking, well, we went through all this social dislocation really for nothing. And so for the rest of the pandemic, there'll continue to be cases, continue to be deaths. It won't be as bad. And we just need to sort of grind it out. Now, that's not the messaging we're getting today, of course, from public health officials. But I do worry that that is sort of what we're going to end up doing as a society at large, is just sort of becoming inured to the amount of death and the number of cases, and that we're just going to end up grinding out the rest of this epidemic until we get vaccines distributed.
I'm wondering about that January 1919 third wave that you mentioned earlier, because I think there are some people who are deeply concerned about what we're going through right now. They almost feel like there are two Americas, right? The ones that are saying, let's just, you know, not see grandma for Thanksgiving and or Christmas, and let's just, you know, batten down the hatches and get through these next couple of months. And others who, to your point, are saying, that's okay, you know, we're just going to get through this as a nation. But there are big differences, as you've mentioned, between the two diseases. And one is that COVID-19 is vastly more contagious. Is that right?
That is true. Yeah, it's at least twice as contagious as influenza in 1918 was. Now, it's less deadly, but it's far more contagious. So that means that the epidemic is going to be longer. We've heard lots of talk about the threshold for herd immunity, which is really a vaccination concept. But what it means in terms of herd immunity is that threshold is about twice as high. So for 1918, that strain of influenza, the threshold for herd immunity was about 30 to 35%. It's about 60 to 70% for COVID because it's much more infectious.
Alex, I had went to Costco recently and looked around at the, you know, thousands of frozen meatballs and other delicacies that one would buy normally for a party. And I kept thinking, well, you know what, this Thanksgiving is a wash, but next year's Thanksgiving is going to be epic. Will we make it? Will we be able by then, given what we know about the history of medicine and these types of illnesses, to get there? Can I have an epic Thanksgiving next year?
I think you can. You know, historians are always a little bit leery about making prognostications of the future. I think, however, we know now that we have at least two and recently a third AstraZeneca vaccine announced that seem to be very effective. There'll be others coming online as well. We're going to have to sort of batten down the hatches as much as we can until we can get these doses distributed. It's going to be a monumental task to get shots into people's arms, and these vaccines require two doses. But I think over the course of the next year of 2021, I think we will slowly see a return to normalcy. And so I would say that if you find any good sales, stock up now for next year, put stuff in the freezer, and be prepared to have a great holiday bash next year.
Epic. Alex Navarro is the Assistant Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Guys, I'm eating junk and watching rubbish.
Let me try that cheesecake.
Is that ice cream?
That's a shake. That's milk and ice cream.
Take a cookie.
Sir, jelly donut, sir.
A jelly donut?
They got a baby Ruth.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Who had coconut?
Life was like a box of chocolates.
Your wife's cookies are out of this world.
The snozzberries taste like snozzberries.
Snozzberries? Who ever heard of a snozzberry?
We're going to round out the hour by taking a trip to the movies, which in 2020 usually means sitting down on the couch and turning on the TV. Some of the year's biggest movies have had their release dates pushed back during the pandemic, but there's still plenty of good stuff to stream from the comfort of your home this weekend. And to figure out what those things are, I'm sitting down virtually with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Allison Wilmore, film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Folks, it's so great to have you back on.
Hi, Tanzina.
Yeah, it's so great to be here.
Hey, we usually do this in person, but, you know, we'll take this as the next best thing. Rafer, most of the Hollywood movies had their release dates pushed back during the pandemic. Is it even possible to recommend new movies this year?
I mean, yeah, there are things out there. I think you have to kind of hunt them down. I mean, I think even before the pandemic, the streaming world seemed pretty overstuffed with series and limited series and films you'd never heard of, with people in them that you'd never heard of. It was a real glut of content. And I think it's an even bigger glut now. I guess there's good and bad to that. You get some pretty great stuff is coming to streaming now. Wonder Woman, 1984, the big sequel, that's going to come to streaming. So there is stuff out there for sure.
Well, we're going to break down what some of those options are for folks who are going to be home this weekend. Allison, your first pick is actually a series anthology called Small Axe from director Steve McQueen. We actually had Steve McQueen and the actor Letitia Wright on the show earlier this month to talk about that series. What stood out to you about the anthology?
Well, what stood out to me in particular is the upcoming episode here in the U.S. called Lover's Rock, which is my favorite of the five. I think they're all very good films, but like Lover's Rock is this just a look at a party, just like one night of a house party in which everyone kind of crams in and it's vibrant. It feels incredibly nostalgic in the age of the pandemic to watch everyone have a great time in a crowded house party with incredible music. But it also really feels like it brings together a lot of the themes of this anthology series, which deals a lot with kind of systemic racism faced by the West Indian community. But in this case, it is this moment of glorious freedom and kind of like sanctuary. And who doesn't need that right now?
I was just going to say, that sounds like exactly what a lot of us need. Rafer, we go to you now. We go from Lover's Rock to one of your picks, which is On the Rocks. Tell us about On the Rocks.
Yeah, this is the reunion of Sofia Coppola and Bill Murray after Lost in Translation. They're back together again. It's a fairly simple little story. Rashida Jones plays this woman who thinks her husband might be cheating on her, and so she turns to an expert in that matter, which is her philandering father, Felix, played by Bill Murray, and the two of them decide to investigate. The husband is played by Damon Wayans, and they're going to investigate him and see if indeed he is cheating with one of his coworkers. And it's a pretty simple, slender little comedy. It reminded me a lot of Woody Allen's Manhattan Murder Mystery, with him and Diane Keaton just kind of romping around Manhattan investigating this mystery. I guess a couple things I liked about this movie was it's a little deeper than it seems on the surface. Felix is this, kind of aging playboy. He's an incorrigible womanizer. He's a chauvinist, but he's also very chivalrous, and he shows his daughter all these little attentions and little acts of love that she's not getting from her husband. They go around Manhattan. He orders her drink for her. He opens the door for her. He decides where they're going to have dinner, and she loves that. She kind of soaks it up, although she knows that in the real world there's also kind of a price to pay for that sort of treatment. So there's a little bit more going on there than you'd think initially. And I guess like Allison's choice, one of the things I liked about this movie is, you get to ride around all over Manhattan again, like you did before the pandemic, and you've got Bill Murray as your guide, and he's taking you to the Bemelman's Bar, and he's taking you to 21, and they're having martinis, over a beautiful dinner, and like Allison, I just felt this deep, deep nostalgia for the days when you could do such things. Not that I ever went to the 21 Club a lot, but it sure would be nice to go and have a martini at a bar these days, I'll tell you,
we spoke to Dr. Fauci earlier in the show, and so I think those days will come back, hopefully. Oh, in the meantime, we are still in the middle of this pandemic, and we have another holiday after Thanksgiving, which is Christmas. And Allison, you have a Christmas movie selection. Now, a lot of these movies can be a little cliche, a little, sweet, if you will. What makes the happiest season your Christmas movie pick?
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like in recent years, the Christmas movie, which I mostly associated with, the Hallmark Channel and maybe Lifetime, Netflix has gotten in on the game, all of these other places, suddenly it's this whole kind of sweeping competitive field. but I think the happiest season, it has a twist, which is that it is a lesbian romantic comedy. It's directed by Clea DuVall, you know, who's also an actor, and it stars Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis as the couple who, because there always has to be a twist in these movies, you know, they are about to go home for the holidays to meet one of their families, and the Kristen Stewart character learns that actually her longtime girlfriend, who she was going to propose to, is not out to her family yet, and thinks that Kristen Stewart is her roommate coming home with her for the holidays. So it is both, it delivers a lot of the kind of like cozy cliches, let's say, that you expect from everyone crammed into a house kind of Christmas movie. And at the same time, it does tackle, I think, a lot of actually kind of complicated emotional feel, like, you know, ups and downs.
Real, with that sounds characters. Like a real issue that someone could actually, you know, confront at the holidays. So it sounds more relatable than we probably think.
Absolutely. And, you know, it really kind of, I think, like, manages to straddle giving you a bit of the kind of cozy, familiar feeling and a bit of, like, the real and, like, maybe sometimes a little dark emotions that come up in over the course of these hijinks.
Sounds like a normal holiday to me. Rafer, we're going to go to you for the final word here. You have a throwback for one of your picks, Beverly Hills Cop. Remind us, this was the Eddie Murphy, I mean, you don't have to remind me, but remind our audience, Beverly Hills Cop. I remember it in its first iteration.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, I just recommended this to a friend of mine who, you know, has a family of, you know, wide range of ages. It's him, his wife. He was looking for a crowd pleaser. You know, he's very much like me. I've got two boys. They're 10 and 12. You know, mostly what they want to watch is comedies, action films, and of course, action comedies. And we've run through all of those. And my wife and I were debating, boy, you know, rated R, Beverly Hills Cop, should we do it? But we took a gamble and it was great. They just fell in love with Eddie Murphy again. He's so funny and cocky and tough in this movie. It was great to hear that old Harold Faltermeyer theme song, you know, Axel F again. And plus the Coming to America sequel is coming out pretty soon. So I thought this was a good way to introduce the kids to the magic of Eddie Murphy.
And it is definitely magic. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and co-host of Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen. And Allison Wilmore is a film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Thanks to you both, folks, and hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
You too, Tanzina.
You too.
And that's our show for today, folks. Hope you're getting your meal all prepped for a safe Thanksgiving tomorrow. And if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast, and you can find that wherever you get your podcasts or at thetakeaway.org. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.